edition of Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Joining me from New York is Rafat Ali. How are you doing?
Good, Mark. How are you doing?
Good. I guess we're the lucky ones who can talk about the Consumer Electronics Show without actually having to be in Las Vegas.
That's true. That's true. Have you ever been to CES before?
I have, and I was actually a judge of kind of like a gadget, you know, roundup of like, you know, the best gadgets at CES once.
Okay.
And it was pretty nightmarish.
I've never been. I mean, we covered CES we've been covering back when I was at Pay Content. We covered CES pretty closely every year, but I never went. It was other people who went. I think for us, content became a part of CES only in the last 5 years, I think, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, it used to be. I mean, well, you can just say. I mean, this Consumer Electronics Show, it's happening all week in Las Vegas, and it's for those who don't know about it. It's got to be one of the biggest conferences anywhere. I mean, it's, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. Just, you know, you walk for miles to actually try to see everything that's there. I mean, and when I was there a few years ago. It was all about, you know, plasma screens and flat screen TVs and everything. And I mean, the funny thing is, when you look at the coverage of it now, it's still the same thing. People are still talking about flat screen, these big flat screen TVs. And I mean, it's basically you try to overwhelm people with the glitziest, most ridiculous kind of displays you can.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think that, of course, this for people who've been following CES this year, no, the biggest conversation is about Apple TV and whether it's going to be launched sometime later this year, I think. And the talk is about a company that never sort of goes there. It's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing about this year's is just that. You know, in the past, there've been, you know, people have talked about tablets, and now I'm sure there's a lot about Android tablets there this year, and new smartphones, and new types of TVs, and new stereo systems, and you know, there's a lot that goes on in the world of electronics, and a lot of it has been kind of connected, smart media being more connected. I mean, that's probably the biggest thing that's happened over the last few years at CES is that, especially in the media world, is, you know, all these kind of over the top TV devices, the Roku, the Boxy, all those things that have kind of sprung up out of CES.
One of the things I'm noticing, and I don't know if you noticed it, and I guess our guests will talk about it, is that it just seems to be more wariness in part of the journalists that are covering it, because I don't know, maybe it's that they're just tired being there.
Yeah.
Or there's just, I think, all the over-the-top gadget coverage over the last, I don't know, 7 to 10 years since the gadget blogs came into existence. Maybe it's finally catching up with a lot of people, and they're just saying enough is enough. Or maybe we're just hearing about it more a bit through social media that we didn't used to hear before. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, Rob Peguero, who's going to join us, who's a Washington Post tech guy. I mean, this is, I think, his 15th or 16th CES. So. I'm sure he'll be able to tell us his own war stories, but I think, yeah, Las Vegas can be a tiring place in general, but, you know, when you add in the amount of stuff that goes on during CES, it's just, you know, everything gets to be a little bit more difficult. You know, you've got a line to go get a cab somewhere, you've got a line to get your food, you've got a line to do this, you know, and it gets to be just so wearing on you. And I think a lot
of
people,
phone doesn't work and the network doesn't work and all the other stuff as well.
Exactly. So I think there's a certain contingent of people who probably love going to this, and then there's probably another contingent of people that are probably happy when it's over and just tired of it. And maybe this is the year where it starts getting smaller. I mean, Apple isn't involved. A lot of other companies are kind of questioning how much they're going to do there. So
Microsoft's last keynote at CES this year as well. So,
yeah, so maybe it is kind of a changing the guard, but, you know, media companies are still very much there and very much talking about things. So, yeah, we'll talk about on this episode of the show, you know, it will be kind of our special CES show for people who are at the show and for people who aren't at the show but are just kind of following it and want to know, you know, what's new, what's exciting. and what it means for media folks. Rob Pegoraro tries to make sense of computers, consumer electronics, the internet, software, and other things through reporting, reviewing, and analysis. From 1999 to 2011, he was a Washington Post tech columnist, and now he writes for a variety of online and print outlets, including Discovery News and USAtoday.com. Welcome, Rob.
Thank you. I should also note one of my clients is the Consumer Electronics Association itself, which runs this particular shindig in Vegas.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit more.
Good.
And also joining us is Mike Masnick, who's the founder and CEO of Floor 64 and editor of the very popular Tech Dirt blog. Welcome, Mike.
Sure, thanks for having me.
So let's first talk about what you guys are seeing at CES. Rafat and I are both either lucky or unlucky to not be there this week, and you know, we just check everything out through the social media and all the coverage that you guys are doing. What does it feel like being there, and how is it different from other shows? You want to start first, Rob?
I would start with Microsoft, which is funny because on the one hand, this is Microsoft that said this is their last year exhibiting on the show floor, their last year doing the traditional opening keynote. On the other hand, I think what they have this year is a lot more relevant than in prior years. With Windows Phone 7, they have a mobile operating system that is not terrible and, in fact, is pretty good in a lot of respects. They're showing off Windows 8, which looks really interesting. It's going to be a huge shift in the Windows interface, which is something Microsoft historically never does. And yet, you know, they're packing up after this year, although obviously all the companies making Windows Phone 7 phones and Windows 8 PCs will be here next year. The other thing, I guess, is how TV-centric this continues to be. People are spending a lot of money trying to figure out ways to make the TV do either run new internet-connected apps or just, you know, if you decided that a one-inch thick TV is just way too grotesquely fat, and there are a couple that are about an eighth or a sixth of an inch thick.
Yeah, so that's interesting. The TVs are still a big deal there. You know, you'd think by now there wouldn't be that much more we can do with TVs, but it's still...
I guess there's a lot of profit in those high-end models.
What about you, Mike? What are you seeing at the show? And, you know, have you reached a point of burnout yet?
Well, I mean, I think everyone who comes here burns out at some point. But I actually haven't even spent that much time on the show floor. You know, a lot of it I've been spending over at the Innovation Policy Summit. But you know, just the you know, probably a couple hours that I have spent on the floor. I mean, it's, you know, pretty much what Rob has said. You know, TVs are still big. I have to admit the really thin TVs are actually, there's something that is kind of impressive about them, but it does feel a little weird because, you know, TVs still seem like kind of old technology. And there's lots of tablets. You know, the Ultrabooks have been, you know, a lot of people are talking about them. But, you know, the floor seems to me, at least, and, you know, Rob has a lot more experience with this show than I do, but, you know, the floor seems pretty similar to what we've seen in the past.
Yeah, sadly, I've long since memorized the exact locations of most of the major exhibitors. I can tell you this year, Panasonic, they expanded a little bit to the east. Tablets are a funny thing here because this is the second year where there's been a lot of tablets that are not named iPad. And last year, pretty much every tablet introduced here failed, and some in just a pretty hideous manner. People are making another, they're giving it another try. And I think what may help some of these is that their manufacturers have noticed that, you know, maybe you should try making a tablet smaller than the iPad, since Apple has said we're not going to do something smaller than that 9.7-inch screen. So you've got, you know, 7-inch tablets, 8-inch tablets. There's a couple of – Samsung has this really overinflated phone called the Galaxy Note with the 5.3-inch screen. That seems a bit much.
Yeah, that one they're really pushing that hard. If you go to the I actually just came from the Samsung booth, and, I mean, they gave a lot of real estate to that, you know, particular one, and I'm not quite sure where that fits into the market.
This Note is an LTE phone, so it's probably going to have some very short battery life, which is another trend I'd throw out there. There's a lot of companies trying to figure out ways to make your gadgets run longer, whether it's add-on battery packs or solar cell chargers. I just saw a fuel cell charger.
So this is a question I guess any of you can answer. So Kindle Fire launched, I guess, a month and a half ago, right, at this point, 2 months ago. And is there any talk of sort of the enhanced ebook readers. And I feel like Kindle Fire was one of the device that I stopped using the earliest. And only like a day after I got it, like 2 days, and that was it. And I wonder if some of that it's this drag that's sort of creeping up into the gadget world. But anyway, those are two separate questions. But firstly, is there any talk of Kindle Fire and other kind of enhanced ebook readers besides the tablets? And secondly, what do you think the gadget creep is finally catching up with us?
I'd say that might have started a long time ago. Ebook readers, it's funny, I think three years ago, they were a big focus at CES. Everyone wanted to have their Kindle competitor, and that's become an instant backwater. No one talks about it anymore. Now it's tablets, tablets, tablets. There are a couple of companies working on color e-ink displays that would have the advantages of the original Kindle's e-ink, like working in the sun and running forever on a charge, but would also do color, which is handy for things like coffee table books, tour guides, stuff like that. So we may see some life in that category again. The Kindle Fire, it seems pretty obvious there's going to be another one. So there was some reporting saying the Fire itself was kind of rushed to market. So wait for the Kindle Fire 2.
Jeez, that's going to be like half a day of work involved in playing with that one.
Right. This is what we do.
What was it about the Kindle Fire that you didn't like, Rafat?
Well, no, it's not about the liking part. It's that, okay, I have a Kindle Fire now. I also have an iPad. I also have a computer. I also have this. I also have that. And then, okay, then what? So one of the things I've also, noticing through Facebook and Twitter and social media is that it just seems that the journalists that are there, the media that are there, are sort of complaining more in terms of stuff that's at CES, or just the fact that they're just tired of everything. I don't know, is it because, as I said in the previous question, is it just sort of gadget creep after like 10 years of gadget blog saturation coverage of the industry? Is it finally catching up, or is it just the fact that we can hear a lot more coming out of social media and Twitter and that kind of stuff?
Ah, right. Okay, that's sort of more of a question about tech journalism. I think, you know, there's a lot of outlets that get into a really traffic-driven mentality. What's going to get us a lot of page views out of CES? So let's throw up, a slideshow a day. What's today's hot gadget? What's this one? Which is bad, because doing that doesn't leave you a whole lot of time to sort of reflect and think about, well, what's the trend here? Yeah, it's neat that I've just seen six interesting tablets, but, is there anything going on behind them that suggests that they're going to do well or not? I reread a post of mine when I saw the Motorola Zoom last year, and I thought, okay, I did sort of note that it's probably not a good sign that Verizon won't talk about a price for this thing and that you have to buy a 3G data package with it. But I gave Google way too much credit for doing a good tablet version of Android. And, maybe I've had a little more time to think, okay, what could go wrong with this?
Right. Mike, cover a lot of this kind of stuff, at least in terms of too much hype, and I wonder what your thoughts are.
It's one of those things, and in terms of what Rob was saying about having time to reflect, that's one of the things that I always try and do with shows like this, is trying not to make major pronouncements about these kinds of things until after the show's over and I'm either on the plane back or over a weekend or something, and I actually get to kind of process what actually sticks in my brain and what things are still bugging me. So I'm not sure that I have a full opinion formed just yet in terms of things, but I think one of the things that's always kind of true about any kind of, disruptive innovation is that it's pretty tough to tell what is disruptive when you first see it. I mean, that's part of what makes it disruptive. And certainly with a show this big, I think, it's natural for kind of, journalists to be cynical in general, and certainly, I fit into that category.
Right, build a whole company around it. Yes.
Yeah, in a lot of ways. But I think it's there's some of that you're seeing, and the fact is that most of the stuff here isn't revolutionary, and most of the stuff here isn't going to change the world, and yet they have PR people and marketing people who are here trying to convince you of that. So I think that is natural, even though it is. But in terms of whether or not there are things here that really really will have a big impact or stuff. I mean, I think it's something that I'll need to spend a little bit more time thinking on.
So one of the things you're there to check out is the policy part of it, and one of the big kind of lightning rods is this Stop Online Piracy Act that's going through Congress and that you've written extensively about. And this is an act that a lot of the kind of content creation companies and media companies are all pushing, and a lot of the technology companies and a lot of kind of the internet pundits and people are kind of against. It sounds like from what you've written so far that there's actually a lot of sentiment against SOPA at CES. Are you seeing that? What have you seen played out there?
The overwhelming sentiment is definitely, against the bill, and it's certainly the general sentiment around the sort of tech and innovation industries. So I don't think that is too surprising. At the same time, you have the exact opposite of that kind of in Congress, where it seems like a lot of people in Congress are for the bill, and certainly in the kind of legacy content industry, lots of folks are for the bill. And so there have been some interesting discussions. It's stayed pretty professional for the most part, but there's definitely a general sense of that this is a bad bill, and that a lot of people here don't want it. And these are people. I mean, a lot of the tech companies, they do have concerns, especially on the trademark side, and the bills do impact the trademark stuff, and they have concerns about that, but they still think that these bills just go too far.
Yeah, and I saw that even the CEA has kind of come out against SOPA as well.
Big time, yeah.
Yeah, really big time. And in some ways that is a little surprising, because certainly, there are many members of CEA who are very, very concerned on the trademark and counterfeiting side, but that really highlights one of the problems of the bill, which is that the bill really mixes in two very, very different things. Counterfeiting physical goods is a particular issue with particular, particular ways to deal with it, versus copyright infringement, which is a really different thing. And I know that they like to say that they're basically the same thing, but they're different in tons of different ways. They're different in the law, they're different in impact, they're different in the way that they work. And if you look at who's really driving the bill, it's not the trademark guys, it's the copyright guys, it's the movie industry and the recording industry, and what they do is they sort of conflate the two different things in order to make an argument, because they can argue credibly that there's an awful lot of copyright infringement online. That's true, but they have trouble arguing credibly that. How much harm is actually caused by it. Some, yeah, probably, almost certainly, there's some harm done by it, but, how much, that's a debate. On the trademark side, they can show harm a little clearer. I mean, they love to use the example of fake drugs that are out there, and that is a very obvious situation where people's health is at risk. But the problem there is that that's actually a really, really small issue. I mean, the number of fake drugs that are out there and that people are buying it that are significant health risks is a very small issue. And I'm not trying to minimize it as an issue, because I think it is something that needs to be dealt with. But to conflate these two things and try and make a big overreaching bill that really kind of changes both the legal and technological framework of how the internet has worked, for decades, that seems like a problem. So I think, it's kind of, visionary in some ways for CEA to recognize that, even though many of their members are very, very interested in and worried about counterfeiting on the trademark side, to actually stand up and say, this bill isn't really what we want on that front.
What do you think will happen in the long run with these bills? I mean, it seems like they were put together in a very kind of clumsy way. They've got their just super overreaching. They don't always make so much sense, to be able to just kind of shut down sites the way that you can with them. Do you think there'll be kind of some major amendments and rewriting before they go into effect? Will they still pass in some way?
It seems like the whole strategy was to rush these things through really quickly. When you look at the ridiculous hearing they had, where Google was set up as, this is the only company that opposes this, but Google can afford to comply with this. the thing is that there is a tradition of this sort of thing. There have been a lot of incredibly overreaching and stupid and, I'd say, greedy bills proposed by the entertainment industry over the years. There was one I wrote about in, like, 2003 by Fritz Hollings that would have mandated including digital rights management usage restriction in pretty much every general-purpose computer made, and if you tampered with it, you could go to jail. Well, that thing died a quick death. But, you know, some people in the content business don't seem to sort of want to let it go. And so I'm less surprised to see EA opposed to this, given that, you know, one of their formative experiences was taking the Betamax case to the Supreme Court, which was a 5-4 win in favor of saying, yes, you can time shift a TV show and it's not a crime to do so.
It's just funny to think that that was actually had to go to the Supreme Court just to figure that
right,
out.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and not just, I mean, not just go to the Supreme Court, but as Rob said, it was a very close vote. I mean, we could be living in a very, very different world if that vote had gone 5-4 the other direction. You know, yeah. I mean, it's overquoted at this point, but, the MPAA's argument, you know, at that time and after it was that, you know, the VCR is to the movie industry as the Boston Strangler is to the woman Home Alone. And, you know, you think of that and you look at that now. And I mean, the really ironic thing is the biggest thing that the MPAA is complaining about today is how the home movie business is being hurt by the Internet. And it's like you wouldn't have a home movie business if you guys had won your Supreme Court case 2 decades
right.
ago. Right. And so, you know, there's this, you know, inability to kind of have any vision beyond, you know, or any forward-looking vision on that side of the debate. You know, they always look back and you know, historically, every one of these innovations, you know, that they've come out against and fought really hard and tried to pass bills and tried to, you know, change the world back to the way that they used to be, you know, when they lose, every time they lose, they end up winning for losing because the market always gets bigger. They always turn out to be new business models. There always turn out to be new opportunities for them. And you know, they always turn out better. And I mean, along the same lines, you know, there's this effort to position it as, you know, the tech world versus the content world. And I think that's silly in a variety of ways. And certainly, I am in the content world. I produce content, and you know, I think this is a terrible bill. And there's certainly lots of other people in the content world who feel the same way. But you know, even more to the point, you know, the tech world has been supplying the tools to the you know, legacy content business and the rest of the content world for ages. They've been supplying all the tools that have allowed them to expand and to make more money and to reach more people. All along, it's a funny kind of battle where, you know, one side is supplying all the weapons for the other side. So I just I think there's just a real lack of vision on the folks who are supporting this.
Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate you guys joining us.
Not a problem.
Sure.
So next we want to talk a little bit about Google Plus integrated into web search. Google search giant has announced that they've been doing these kind of personalized search results where you do a search for something and you know, you see things beyond just what kind of everyone else sees when they do a search. You actually see search results that are tailored to your own interests, your own previous searches, other sites you've been to. And now they've kind of come out with this new kind of search plus your world, is what they're calling it. But basically, it's taking what's going on in Google Plus. And if you're involved with that and you're signed on, you start to see kind of a search through your social results in Google Plus. That move has, which, you know, the strange thing about it is that, you know, you might have shared something in a private group of people on Google Plus, which, you know, lets you limit who you kind of share things with, like a photo, let's say. And then you do a Google search and you see this kind of privately shared photo pop up in the search. And
but isn't that only shown to you, not to everybody else?
It's only shown
sharing?
To you. But there's some weird – it's just, I guess it's just that weird feeling of like you're doing a Google search, which just feels like it's public, but you're seeing private things within that public search. And that's what kind of confuses people.
One of my things is, and I have this question for you.
Yeah.
So this only got turned on when yesterday, or was it day before.
Yeah.
And when I searched something and then it popped up saying search your world, and there was a explanation there saying if you don't want to see it, just click here. And I clicked here. It's done. It's over. It's out of my mind. Why should I care after this?
Well, I think you're smart enough to do that. I think most people, you know, the thing is it opts everyone in. So it's not like you decide, I want to have this. It's just there no matter what. And it's just, you know, like I said, I think it, like my experience is it was a little confusing. Like if I search for my name on Google, which of course, you know, that's what everyone's going to do.
Right.
You know, it brings up this just kind of strange thing where, you know, the personalized search is basically a lot of things that I've written in Google Plus. It's not. Now, if I look at my kind of plain vanilla search, it has my Twitter feed as the first thing that comes up. And this is the thing that actually, you know, Twitter has kind of made a statement saying, you know, they're upset that Google has done this. They think that it's unfair to Twitter. You know, Facebook, I'm guessing, probably feels the same way. You know, right. If we really, if you know, those of us who are very involved in social networks, you know, we have a lot of stuff we've shared on all the networks, right? And if right. we really want to search all of our private stuff on all the networks, that's what we really want. We want like an actual search of everything that we have that's private, if that's what we really are looking for.
And as Google, a separate part, as separate from, let's say, Google search.
Or that's, you know, people consider Google as like their search engine. Obviously, there's Bing and there's Ask and there's other search engines.
No, search as in like the Google search tab versus, let's say, I'm going to go on a private tab, which will have Google Plus or and Facebook and Twitter and whatever else I have. Also,
make a lot more sense, having like a tab that brought up your private information and that you at least had a feeling you knew you were seeing it. I guess it's when you mix the public and the private that gets kind of confusing, not only as a user experience, but just as your own personal feeling of like, this is kind of strange seeing something. And, you know, this is a thing where I'm noticing now on my computer at home that, you know, it's kind of like who's seeing your computer. You know, when are you logged in and logged out of Facebook? When are you logged in and logged out of Google? You know, who might use your computer and see these things? You know, it might not just be you using the computer if it's a family computer.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're probably right on the feeling weird part. Of course, if there was like a private search engine, even if it's, let's say, run by Google, the problem is Facebook and Twitter and others will not play fair, or at least would want Google to play as fair as they want out of Google. And like, why would Facebook allow Google to crawl all the private stuff? You would presumably have to log in, you would have to connect Facebook Connect, whatever it's called, to Google, and like Twitter to Google. But like those, it's assuming that all three companies will work with each other, which is highly unlikely.
Yeah, and in a way it's too bad, because that's probably the experience that we really want. And the thing that we're missing is that, you know, we want to be able to get to search all those places, because those are the places that we're at. And a lot of people like Danny Sullivan at Search Engine Land wrote up something about, you know, what are the issues with this, and, you know, shouldn't those companies kind of be on board with this to make it work? And, you know, Twitter had an agreement with Google before that kind of ran out, and maybe Google is using this as some kind of negotiating ploy, like, you know, look how cool this would be if we could kind of integrate all the social stuff into our search, and don't you want to be a part of this, Facebook, and don't you want to be a part of this, Twitter? But, you know, maybe they're just saying, well, no, we want to do our own thing and we don't really want to play nice with you.
And I guess they're also assuming, and I think a bunch of people said that, people, they'll probably force people into using Google Plus, which for me, I mean, I know you're big on Google Plus, or at least using it, or you're using Google Plus. I don't use it at all at this point. I mean, it's there. I have a few thousand followers, but like, that's it. And I'm sure a lot of people have that same experience. I mean, on the other hand, a lot of people are using it too. It just seems like what this will do, I think some other people have written this, it will only create more noise from media. for media companies and others who will start using Google Plus more to make sure that they're on top of the results, and that will just create more sort of cluttered and spamish behavior.
You know, the thing about this move is it seems a little clunky. It seems a little forced. It seems a little bit kind of heavy-handed. And Google has kind of said, you know, who knows how many times that, you know, we're not going to ever favor ourselves in search results. We're not, you know, we're not going to make our YouTube videos show up before other videos, or, you know, whatever it is. They've tried to say that, you know, they're going to always be neutral when it comes to Google search. And now this is the one time where people can say, no, this is not fair. You know, this is wrong. This could be a monopoly behavior. This could be pushing one of their things ahead of competitors. This is going to be something that's going to end up biting them, you know, in an antitrust investigation.
Yeah, that's what I've read too as well.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens. I mean, it's definitely caused a little bit of a tempest in a teapot. The question is, you know, whether it's going to lead to more than that.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift. Along with my co-host, Rafat Ali, we want to thank our special guests, Mike Masnick from Tech Dirt, as well as Rob Pigorero, tech journalist, both reporting from CES. We want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to check out all the news, polls, and events over at PBS MediaShift at pbs.org/MediaShift and our sister site, IdeaLab, at pbs.org/IdeaLab. We'll catch you next week.